Everywhere we go, we bump into things that remind us of good stories. And looking down into the Boston Navy Yard from the new Mystic Bridge onto the frigate Constitution a few days ago, I was reminded that back in 1834, a young Cape Cod lad boarded old Ironsides and cut the head of President Andrew Jackson right off. The figurehead, that is. This rash and seemingly foolish act of vandalism plunged the whole country into a free-for-all controversy, echoes of which haven't died down yet. And because I know a lot of you never heard the details or what was back of this beheading business, I'm going to tell the whole story. Andrew Jackson, better known perhaps as Old Hickory, was born on the boundary of the Carolinas. And as a boy, was noted for his quick temper, his stubbornness, and his preference to settle all differences with a fight. He quit school when he was 13 and ran away to war with his older brother. Captured by the British, the boys were ordered to blacken the boots of an officer. Andy Jackson told off the English officers and received for his fresh remarks a saber slash that marked him for life. And long as he lived, Andrew Jackson never forgot or forgave the Englishman who clipped him. Jackson was unfortunate in some of the friendships he made, but once declared, he stuck by them regardless, as in the case of Aaron Burr. He met Burr while he was a judge in Tennessee and liked him. And even when Burr was tried for treason in 1807, Jackson was still his champion. As I said, he was a fighter, an uncouth, rough, and ready man with little regard for the niceties of life. And from the very first, he had a magnetic appeal for the poor and the working classes. They saw in Old Hickory their champion, and they overlooked his pugnaciousness, his frequent outbursts of anger, his astonishing indiscretions. For example, Jackson resented a remark by Colonel Avery during a court trial and immediately challenged his legal opponent to a duel. Both men missed, so no harm was done. Then he shot and killed Charles Dickinson in a duel and got a bad wound himself, and he was further wounded in another gun battle with the Benton brothers in a Nashville tavern. But afterwards, they patched up their differences and became good friends. This kind of trigger temperament might go in the backwoods, but it was hardly a recommendation for a man who sought the high office of the president. Before he reached that goal, Jackson served with distinction in the army, being quickly promoted to major general. And in November 1814, he captured the British base at Pensacola, Florida, then owned by Spain. And 2 months later, January 1815, Jackson inflicted another severe defeat on the enemy at New Orleans, and later was appointed military governor of the territory of Florida. There, he ruled with an iron hand. He inflicted severe punishments on the Seminole Indians, established martial law, kicked a local judge out of town, and got himself fined $1,000 for contempt of court. But all this made him a hero with the underdogs. And in 1828, because of his fearlessness and his theory that big business and the banks were making slaves of the poor working classes, he was elected the 7th president of the United States. Now, the Democratic Party had already split into two factions. One followed their fiery leader, Old Hickory, and the other became the National Republican Party, under Henry Clay and John Quincy Adams. That presidential campaign of Adams versus Jackson hit an all-time low in dirty politics. A long time before this, Ed married a childhood sweetheart who had been divorced, at least they thought she had, and when they learned that through an oversight the divorce decree had not been final, the Jacksons, being entirely innocent, went to a parson and got married again. But some sly, conniving politicians, digging around in the records to see what dirt they could find, spread the story that the Democratic candidate had lived 2 years with a woman who was not legally his wife. The newspapers, many of them owned by Republicans, made a lot of this ridiculous charge, and Jackson blamed Adams for not suppressing it. Then the Democrats slung a bit of choice mud back at the urbane candidate for Massachusetts. Up to this time, the character of John Quincy Adams was considered above reproach. But some slick smarty pants drummed up a story that when Mr. Adams was minister to Russia and wanted to get on the good side of the Tsar, he sold a beautiful American girl to one of the Russian officers. Now, those are just two of the stunts that were pulled back in the old days. And the outcome was that enough folks believed the Russian hoax or sympathized with Jackson so that he was elected. I might add that Mrs. Jackson was very ill at the time of the campaign, and fearing for her health, Old Hickory allowed no newspapers containing the scandal to reach her. She found them, however, soon after the election was over, and she was so shocked and heartbroken, she died within 2 weeks. Naturally, this increased Jackson's bitterness, and believing that Adams could have called off the newspapers, he said savagely, "That man from Massachusetts is the basest, meanest scoundrel that ever disgraced the image of his God." In his History of the United States, James Truslow Adams says, "Democracy was seating itself in the saddle, and in 1828 it rode high." Biographers agree that John Quincy Adams wouldn't think of stooping to ask an office holder how he voted. And as for firing him for that, it was unthinkable. But not so with Old Hickory. He believed that any man who got votes and helped elect the ticket should be rewarded. And right there, the spoils system, which is spread all through our federal, state, county, yes, even down into town offices, had its beginning. Looking up this matter of political patronage, I found that in the 8 years that Washington was president, he dismissed only 9 federal office holders. Old John Adams fired 10, Jefferson in 8 years removed 39, Madison fired 8 during his 5 years in office, and Monroe 8 in 9 years. But when Andrew Jackson got in, his new broom swept clean. Over 500 federal office holders were fired, many of them postmasters, simply because they were Republicans. And there were social troubles, too. Half the cabinet officers' wives weren't on speaking terms with the other half, and that situation led to all kinds of complications. And it was soon seen that while Jackson was a strong personality himself, his cabinet, with the exception of Martin Van Buren, was most mediocre. This led Old Hickory to call on his cronies for advice. And he took so much stock and paid so much attention in the suggestions they made, the little White House clique became known as Jackson's Kitchen Cabinet. On the day of his inauguration, an excited, shouting, half-crazy crowd, which most writers referred to as a mixed mob, followed their hero from the Capitol to the White House, where they trampled down the lawns, tore up the flower beds, and broke down the fences. The few thousands who managed to push inside tracked mud and sand over the carpets and ruined the satin-covered furniture, and they grabbed whatever was within reach for personal souvenirs. Judge Story of Marblehead, then a member of the Supreme Court, wrote disgustedly of the goings-on at Jackson's inauguration, saying, "Why, they pounced on the food and drank up the wine. They fought among themselves like roustabouts. They ruined the beautiful furnishings. Only when huge bowls of punch were placed out on the lawn could that mob be lured outside." This mad scramble for food and drink on Jackson's inauguration day, says James Truslow Adams, was but a sideshow to the three-ring circus of office-seeking. In the Senate, Mr. William L. Massey announced openly, "To the victor belongs the spoils." And I'm sorry to say the spoil system has been the disgrace of American politics ever since. Jackson had barely taken office when a social scandal shook the White House. Not anything really bad, just one of those rows between jealous, socially inebriated females. Seems that Major Eaton, Jackson's newly appointed Secretary of War, had just married a certain Peggy O'Neill, whose father kept the tavern where Eaton had boarded for several years. It was true that Peggy was no blue blood, and her first husband had committed suicide. But many of the tales told about her were ugly gossip. But still, the wives of the cabinet officers demanded that Major Eaton be fired and a new Secretary of War be appointed. They got a group of clergymen to go call on the president, and they made the same suggestion, to which Old Hickory thundered, "I didn't come down here to form a cabinet for Washington women, but for the nation." And hardly had the clergymen departed when word came that 100 congressmen were marching on the executive mansion to ask for Eaton's dismissal. Jackson shook his shaggy head and bellowed, "Let 'em come. Bring the whole 100 in. Give 'em wine and cigars. But I shall not desert my good friend Eaton, nor shall I be forced into any action against my will." Because of his appeal to the masses, Jackson was reelected. And the nation then, in 1832, faced a problem which faced this generation just 100 years later, a bank crisis. Jackson didn't like big business, and he had no use for corporations, and he was determined from the first to put the National Bank, the chief depository of national funds, out of business. According to law, the national funds had been placed in the National Bank and could be withdrawn only by the Secretary of the Treasury if he found that that bank was financially unsound. However, Jackson ordered Secretary of the Treasury McLean not to deposit any more of the country's money in that bank, in spite of the fact that its resources exceeded the liabilities by $42 million. McLean refused and was promptly fired. His successor, William J. Duane, was ordered to withdraw the funds, and when he refused, he got the axe. The third man Jackson appointed, Robert Taney, did as he was told, and that was a fatal mistake. The Senate, acting on a resolution of Henry Clay, declared the president had exceeded his authority, and he was officially censured, but it was too late. Under unwise laws and without the careful restraint observed by the National Bank, the country's currency soon became inflated and a depression was underway. All during Jackson's terms, we had been going through a series of speculative debauches, heavily discounting the future development of the nation and getting deeper and deeper into debt. Part of the $500 million debt, which was a lot of money in those times, was tied up in land. All over the eastern seaboard, which of course included New England, farmlands were boomed to bursting. On Long Island, for instance, and up in Maine, tracts of ordinary wasteland were sold in some cases at 1,000% above their ordinary worth. Businessmen, seeing the handwriting on the wall, tried to stop the avalanche, but it was no use. Firm after firm closed its doors. Stores failed, and banks closed. All the shipping was tied up and finally stopped. And in one day, May the 9th, 1836, $650,000 in solid coin, that means gold and silver coin, was withdrawn from the savings banks in New York City alone. And what happened in New York happened also in Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Boston. And according to some historians, this panic, started by Jackson's move against the National Bank, set the progress of the country back 20 years. Here in New England, 9/10 of the factories and mills closed down. Thousands walked the streets. Hundreds of families were actually on the verge of starvation. So, in view of all this, it's not difficult to understand why Andrew Jackson was so universally hated here in New England, and why the mere thought of having his image as a figurehead for the Frigate Constitution made sober, sensible citizens around Boston see red. This also explains why all over the nation there was great rejoicing when a Cape Cod sea captain climbed aboard the Constitution during a thunderstorm and cut the president's head clean off. I shall have more to say about that exciting incident in our little history lesson next Sunday.